This is HPR episode 1852 entitled, Operation Wallasia. It is hosted by Dave Morris and is about 29 minutes long. The summary is, I talked to my daughter about her recent trip to Indonesia.
This episode of HPR is brought to you by anhonesthost.com. Get 15% discount on all shared hosting with the offer code HPR15. That's HPR15. Better web hosting that's honest and fair at anhonesthost.com.
Hello everybody, this is Dave Morris. Today I'm sitting at the kitchen table talking to my daughter, Clara.
Hi.
It's currently the end of August and the summer vacation is moving towards its close in the UK. And so soon Clara will be heading back to university for her second year.
Yep.
And this vacation has been quite an interesting and busy one for Clara, and I'd like just to talk about what she's been doing, because I think it might be of interest. So, Clara, you were out of the country for several weeks from June this year. Where were you and what were you doing?
Well, I was away for 4 weeks. I was in an island called Hoga, which is in Indonesia. It's part of the Wakatobi Natural Reserve in Indonesia.
It's a very hard place to spot if you look for it on a map.
Yeah, it's really remote.
Yeah, incredibly remote, very, very tiny, and it's near to the island of Sulawesi, is what I understand about it.
Near the Wallacea line.
Right, and Wallacea is a name given to that region, isn't it?
It was named... it's named the Wallacea Line because it marks like a split in different biodiversity
right
through Indonesia. And it's named that after the scientist Alfred Russel Wallace.
Right. He was a contemporary of Darwin.
Yeah.
And a collaborator with Darwin.
Yes.
At various points, wasn't he? Yeah. Okay, I find that really quite exciting that still exists.
The company I was working with as well was named Wallacea. It's called Operation Wallacea because Indonesia is where it first started operating. It's a company it's a non-profit organization that works with conservation and sort of monitoring biodiversity in very remote areas.
Right, okay. And they have a sort of base of operations out there, don't they?
Yeah, well they have different projects in lots of different countries.
Yes, but they have one there in particular.
Yeah, that's where they started.
Yes. So how did you happen to get involved with this thing then? How did you hear about it?
Well, we had a meeting at the university. I think it was a group leader sort of event where basically that's someone who has previously worked with Operation Wallacea who wants to go out and do another project with them.
Right.
And they basically get all the sort of information and resources from Operation Wallacea, then go to a university and advertise it. And depending on how many people they get to sign up, they get a discount on the next expedition. So, you know, they say they get 10 people to sign up. That's basically all the expedition paid for.
Right, right. As I understand it, this Operation Wallacea is largely funded through having students come out and volunteers.
The students paying to be there is really what's funding the projects.
There's I'll be putting a link to their website in the notes for this show. So if anybody's interested, they can go and look for the details there. But it required you to get some funding to do this, didn't it?
Yeah. They recommend you go out and do fundraising, which didn't exactly work out. I did earn a bit of money, but not as much as I hoped to, because we had a few people in St. Andrews who were interested in fundraising, but they didn't seem very organized, and we didn't really organize any big group events.
Right. And there's not a lot of fundraising opportunities in a small town like St. Andrews.
It's quite difficult, and I mean, like, the only things we were thinking of, a few options, like selling stuff like food outside of the library, but then there's so much competition from like societies from the university to do that sort of thing.
Right. But you applied for a grant though, didn't you?
Yeah, that was another thing they recommended you doing. Mm-hmm. So Operation Wallacea themselves had a grant called the Alfred Russel Wallace Grant, inspired by, you know, Alfred Russel Wallace, because he was the person who discovered and named the Wallacea line. And you had to write about yourself and also write about Alfred Russel Wallace and...
Right, you had to do an essay type of thing.
Yeah.
And then based on that, you either did or didn't get a grant.
Yeah.
And you did.
I did get a grant, yeah.
Yeah, that was very cool.
I think probably a bit of sort of politics involved in that, because I think they sort of like to pick, based on what I've seen from previous years, they like to pick one person from each university.
Okay.
So I think, especially because St. Andrews as well is quite a sort of prestigious Scottish university, they were like, right, we're going to have one person from St. Andrews. So I think I didn't really have much competition because there weren't many people from St. Andrews who were going.
Yeah.
There was like maybe one or two people other than me. So I didn't really have that much competition. Mm-hmm. So
it
worked out quite well.
You headed off in June.
Mid-June.
You were aware that there were going to be a bunch of other people flying out there as well, weren't you?
Yeah.
So how long did it take you to get there? You probably can't remember in detail, but just tell us about what sort of trip it was.
It was a very long journey.
As well over 30 hours in total, as I recall. Yeah.
So there was like about three or four planes I had to take.
Mm-hmm.
So there was one, I took one straight from Edinburgh to Qatar.
Mm-hmm.
And then from Qatar to Jakarta in Indonesia, and then another plane from Jakarta to Makassar, which is another island in Indonesia. And as we went on, the planes were getting smaller and smaller.
Yeah. That's also in Sulawesi, I think, isn't it?
Yeah, first one was about 7 hours, and the second was nine,
mm-hmm.
and then the third, I think, was about 4 hours. I can't quite remember. Mm-hmm. And then we took a plane from Makassar out to Wakatobi.
Wakatobi is the name of an island chain
out
there. It's named after the initial letters of the islands I discovered.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that was a really small plane. Like about 100 people fit in
mm-hmm.
it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, it was quite... It was that journey on that plane took about 2 hours.
Right.
So
that was a little turboprop plane, I think.
Yeah.
Okay, and then once you got to the islands, what happened then?
Well, we sort of landed inland, so we got put in cars and taken out to the coast,
mm-hmm.
where they had a dock, and we went on a boat, a really rickety sort of boat. The windows were just sort of open rectangles in the boat, and they had to sort of pull up this wooden bit so that the water didn't splash in. And they were like, don't sit on the floors because the water will flood in and you'll get wet. So sit on top of this, like, they had a sort of underboat thing to put our luggage in.
Mm-hmm.
And it had like a top to it, so we all had to sort of sit on that.
All right. Keep out of the water that was coming into the boat.
Yeah, so you're above the water level.
But there's lots of transport around between those islands. So whoever was running this obviously did this every day and knew exactly.
Not every day, every week, because that's when we would get new people in.
But possibly doing it for other people as well, shipping people around between the islands.
I think that
it's like
big
sort
boat
of island taxis,
was
isn't it?
That big boat was specifically for Opwall.
Oh right, okay.
I think like the locals, because it's a very fishing heavy community.
Mm-hmm.
Especially, it's very close to an island called Sempele. Some of you might recognise it because it's famous for being this village out in the ocean.
Right.
That's
right.
Been built out in the ocean, and it the residents of it are used to be nomadic fishermen, and they used to live their whole lives out in the ocean in little boats, and they were pressured by the Indonesian government to settle. So it's a very, the community around that area is very sort of centred around fishing. So a lot of people, all the locals sort of own boat.
Right,
so that's how usually
mm-hmm.
that's how they travel out.
Okay.
Yeah, that was a 2-hour boat journey when we got there.
Yeah. And nobody was seasick, I hope.
No one threw up.
No,
so.
Okay. So then you were finally on Hogar Island.
Yeah.
And so what was that like once you got there? What was your impression of it?
It's a really lovely place. It's very you could imagine it being pictures of it being advertised in like a brochure
mm-hmm.
as like a sort of exotic paradise.
Yes, it's a paradise island.
It was kind of, it was also kind of dangerous at the same time. It was like, it's exciting but dangerous. Like we got there and we got a big presentation on everything that could kill us.
That's nice.
From both animals and the terrain, because there were paths had been constructed throughout the island, and we were told we can't go past certain points, because partly because it was owned by the locals, and also because like they didn't have proper paths built there.
Mm-hmm.
And like we had to, because there were no lights when we went out to our huts at night, we had to carry torches and we had to stick to the path, because if we went off the path you could fall into a coral hole.
Oh,
and
right.
These big jaggedy rocky holes, and they were like, yeah, we won't find you in there. Or at least you'll get really badly scraped up.
Yeah. So you'll be there all night possibly until somebody finds you or something.
And there's lots of Komodo dragons in there.
Really?
I don't know if there are Komodo dragons.
Okay. I mean, it is the area for them, but hopefully there's not too many of them stalking around. Wow. Yeah, you want to watch those guys.
And then there were snakes as well.
Yeah.
There were a few people who actually saw, big sort of hooded cobras.
Oh, right. Wow.
And, well, that was just on land. And in the ocean, there was tons of stuff that could kill you, stonefish and...
what are they called? The cone fish? The
cone shells?
Oh, yeah, they are called cone shells.
Yeah.
They are called cone shells.
Because they're venomous... venomous shellfish, aren't they?
One of the most venomous creatures. I think it's the most venomous sea creature. Like, they were saying that if you get jabbed by them, and you had to be careful because the stinger is, it can extend to twice their body length.
Mm.
But, yeah, if you get stung by that, you're dead within half an hour. So, you get stung by that, you're doomed. You're finished.
Yes.
Stonefish was a bit safer because, I mean, you die within 5 hours, but... that might just be enough time to take you to, a hospital.
Which was 2 hours away by boat.
More than that.
Oh, yeah,
because you'd
have
to get a boat out and then a plane.
Oh,
because the closest, the closest hospital was, on Bali.
Because
we were really remote.
That's a long way.
Out. So there was, there was a sort of basic clinic for first aid. And mm-hmm. they had a doctor that, you could go to if you were unwell or anything. But, yeah, they couldn't really do much for you if you got
mm-hmm.
sick.
Mm. Wow, it's a good thing you made it back.
Yeah, well, we were talking about this because, of course, everyone was very sort of paranoid. They were like, oh, my God, there's so many things in the ocean that can kill you. And we were told that, no one had actually died out in Indonesia yet.
Oh,
I don't think anyone... They were also warning us about decompression sickness because we were scuba diving. And they said that no one had to be, transported away because of decompression sickness.
Right.
So no big emergencies.
Again, a problem, because there's no decompression facilities.
But, yeah, it was quite concerning.
Yeah.
Especially because you saw quite a lot of these creatures.
Yes.
And specifically, I did some... I'll talk about it in more detail, but one of the things I did was reef survey techniques, and so they were getting us to ID invertebrates, and they were wanting us to find... they wanted us to ID a specific type of, shelled invertebrate, and they were saying how it looked kind of like a cone shell, and sometimes mistake it as a cone shell, and they said if you're turning it over to make sure it's alive, because you have to make sure it's alive to tally it, do it with your board or your pencil, not with your finger. And I was just like, I'm not gonna touch it.
I'm not counting them.
No.
So who else was there with you then? This is quite a busy place, I take it.
Yeah, well, there were lots of different people of different age groups, but you had the staff. The sort of main staff were, scientists, actual scientists mm-hmm. or teachers mm-hmm. and that sort of thing. And then you had, the diving masters who varied in age a lot. One of the women specifically who taught me diving was just, a year or two older than me.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, and then we had the dissertation students who were... they must have been fourth year university students who had gone out to do their dissertation in Indonesia, and they were out for about 6 weeks. And then you had the research assistants, which was what I was, who are the people who went out to assist the dissertation students.
Very good.
Yeah.
There's also quite a number of people on Hogar Island that live there permanently.
Well, yeah, we had, other than sort of the people in charge, all the sort of staff, the people who were cooking for us,
mm-hmm.
the people who owned our huts as well, because we had landlords. So everyone had a different style of hut, and mm-hmm. some people had better landlords than others. There were some that baked people cakes and donuts,
right.
and the others, I never saw my landlord at all. I don't think, Like, I think the first time I saw him and the last time I saw him was when he took us to our hut, and then that was it.
Right.
Whereas other people were like, it would come in, they'd be like, oh, do you want some cake? My landlord made us cake. Mm. And I'm like, everyone was like, oh, damn you.
I was going to ask you what you were doing there. You've covered quite a lot of that, really. But you weren't able...
I did a different thing every week, pretty much.
Because what did you start off with? Because you had to get skills first before you could
on
actually
paper,
do stuff.
On paper, I was a research assistant, but I was only a research assistant technically for 1 week. So basically, everyone who didn't have a PADI certification, and PADI's the organisation that you train with and you get a certification with to scuba dive. I think there are different organisations you can do it with, but PADI's one of the sort of universally accepted ones.
Mm-hmm.
So you can pretty much go anywhere in the globe and say, oh, we've got PADI certification. They go, oh, all right, you can scuba dive.
Yeah.
So we spent the first week doing that. It was surprising how short that time was. It wasn't even a full week, it was about 5 days.
Mm-hmm.
I think I got my PADI certification within those 5 days. It was like we started on Wednesday, and then I'd finished by Saturday morning. That was the last dive we did, and it was like, okay, you're done.
Wow. But it was pretty intensive stuff, wasn't it?
You were
diving all day pretty much, or
yeah, we were getting up at like 5 a.m.
Mm-hmm.
before the sun had even risen. And getting ready and going out to do theory stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And then we'd go out and do diving. And we had, like, it was something like you had to do 4 confined dives, which were, usually you'd do in a pool, but because we didn't have pools and we had the ocean instead,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
You go out into the ocean. And it would be, like, I think you had to be within 5 meters of the surface. And, like, the first one we did, we were just sort of kneeling down in the water to mm-hmm. sort of get used to our regulators and that sort of thing.
Yep.
And then we sort of steadily went deeper and deeper down. And it was really interesting because you sort of, at the beginning, you're sort of like, oh, God, like, how am I going to do this? This is really, like, you think about being underwater, like, 10 meters down
mm-hmm.
with just a regulator for your air. And if something goes wrong, you're like, this is really concerning. I don't know if I can deal with this. But then by the end of it, you're just sort of like, yeah, this is fine. I can deal with this. It's good.
Yeah, yeah. Getting over that instinctive fear of putting your head under the water not wanting to breathe because you breathe water in and stuff is quite a difficult thing to master, mm-hmm. I'm sure.
Yeah. I mean, I was by no means an expert, because the following week I found, like, my buoyancy was all over the place. It was a bit more stressful because we were doing what was called reef survey techniques, mm-hmm. and that was basically them training us to be able to ID species, various species on the reef, and go out and do the sort of practical survey techniques.
Yeah.
So things like rugosity, which is measuring like how smooth the bed surface is.
Right.
Or things like we were using quadrats and transect lines, and measuring like a number of species within an area,
mm-hmm.
and that sort of thing. It was everything from coral, like soft and hard coral, to invertebrates, to fish, and all of that sort of stuff. And we did seaweed and seagrasses as well. But yeah, it was a bit stressful because they were like, right, you need to go down and do this stuff, and you need to maintain your buoyancy, because if you don't maintain your buoyancy, you're going to knock into stuff.
Yes.
And and we were all like just sort of flailing around going, ah. It took me until like half the week to like have my weights right,
because
it was like, I think, because your weight's a weird thing, and your buoyancy's dependent on how you breathe as well.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I was overweighted at the beginning, because I was like in the first week we were having to sit on these like bamboo mats to do various exercises, like taking off our masks and
mm-hmm.
that sort of thing, and I could not stay down. I think it was because I was nervous, and so because I was slightly nervous, I wasn't completely relaxed. I hadn't breathed out all the oxygen
in my
body, so it's like in a swimming pool. Like, when you breathe out entirely, then you can sink, but when you breathe in, you float up.
Yes.
And it was like, because of that, I was overweighted, and so I started the first week, and I was like sinking, and I kept having to constantly put air in my BCD, and then I was like, oh, I'm too overweighted, and so I took weights away, and then I was too underweighted.
Oh, no.
We had one where we went out to San Paolo, which luckily wasn't a really biodiverse area, because otherwise I would have, like,
you'd have been bumping,
I would have,
there,
like, just destroyed a whole bed of coral, because I literally just fell to the bottom of the ground, and I was like, I can't, like, I was either floating up or I was sinking. It was awful. And the dive master who was with us, he was like, at the end, I basically had to just sort of pull you along like a balloon, because I just kept floating up.
Oh dear, that's yes. So tie a string to you, and then yeah. Break.
But yeah, it took a while for everyone to sort of get used to the buoyancy.
Yes, of course. But that's what you're there for, isn't it? To learn these things.
I mean, luckily I was able to do some snorkeling as well, which is really fun. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. You do that on the reef flat, and you sort of duck dive down, and you tuck like the transect under stuff, and then that was fun. That was really fun. Yes.
Sounds fantastic.
Yeah.
I'm sure a lot of people would be very jealous to hear about your experience. But
we also had a test at the end of that week. People were quite frustrated by that.
Yes, you said you had an exam.
Yeah, because we had to learn all the Latin names of all the different species. Yeah, yeah. It was like about 100 species or something, and we had to... They would have slide... The exam was basically, they showed like 40 slides or something, mm-hmm. and you had to... It would say family or genus or something like that, and you have to write down the Latin name. So it was so much memorization.
Yeah.
And you were covering something new like every single day, so it was really quite stressful. But I passed. So, I passed first time, so
very good.
It worked out.
So it was not a sort of relaxing holiday. It was all go.
No, it was not relaxing.
But still very rewarding.
Yeah. So, I had the third week I did reef monitoring. Yeah, mm-hmm. I did reef monitoring,
mm-hmm.
which is something they do in Operation Wallacea where they basically monitor the diversity of different various species in the reef, and they use that to determine how healthy the reef is, mm-hmm. and whether or not it's been damaged over the various years.
Survey.
And they sort of give it into the government so they mm-hmm. can.
Okay.
You know, make and
that
about
you got some. There was some fairly fancy equipment involved in that one, was there?
Yeah, there was they used this like stereoscopic camera, which was basically like two cameras on the end of like this big stick that mm-hmm. people, like one person would swim around down transect with it, and it would monitor all the fish. And then they put into a program which you could use to measure the fish. It was very finicky,
mm-hmm.
but yeah, we would wake up really early and go out in two consecutive dives, which was really tiring. It's very exhausting. You had to get up, go on a dive at 7, and then come back, get all your gear off, and then you'd have about half an hour to mm-hmm. rest, and then you have to set all your gear back up, and then go out again.
Capturing this
getting this stuff. And then after that, you'd have a bit of a break for lunch, and mm-hmm. maybe enough time to go and have, like, a mandi, which is how we bathed, which was basically buckets of water. And then we had, like, a sort of smaller pail that you sort of picked up the water and poured over you, because we had no running water.
No.
So that was... I mean, we had a... No, we didn't have any running water.
Mm.
I mean, yeah, no, I don't know what I'm thinking.
Not in your heart, at least.
No, I don't think we had running water anyway, because I was just thinking of, did we have taps? And no, we didn't. We had a bucket that you just poured water out onto your hands.
In a well somewhere, maybe, was it?
Well, they brought in on the ships.
Oh, right.
Fresh water.
Because there is no fresh water on the island itself.
Because you're surrounded by the sea.
Yeah, yeah. And it's on some sort of old coral base, isn't it? It's a,
mm-hmm.
it's whatever you call that when an island forms over the top of the coral.
So after lunch, we'd go to the lab, and they'd have filmed like transect lines, and we'd sort of stop the video every sort of half a meter,
mm-hmm.
and you'd write down what was there, so like rock or sand or whatever species of coral or whatever was there, and or we'd do the sort of fish videos,
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
and that was for a week, and then the last week. Last week I was a research assistant, and it was quite a busy week as well. I was in the water at least 3 times a day,
mm-hmm.
because there was two research assistants at that point, because everyone else who had done like training with me had gone off to do something called the culture course, which mm-hmm. is where you went around the surrounding islands and sort of got an idea of, you know, you sort of experienced the culture and that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. So they went to mm-hmm. San Pella and met people there and got to see what the lifestyle was like. And that was it sounded really interesting, and I think I would have done it if I had more time. But being from, like, with my mum being from Indonesia, I've had a lot of experience with Indonesian culture. So there was a lot of stuff that people were surprised by that I was like, oh yeah, that's Indonesia. Like the whole, like the neglectance of rubbish. Like mm-hmm. they would just throw it out. Like mm-hmm. there was one girl who was saying, who was really shocked because she found that her landlord just basically would grab the rubbish and just throw it down a coral hole. And she was like, this is, how can they do this? This is, mm-hmm. like, they're ruining the island they live on. And I was like, yeah, that sounds like Indonesia, because it's the sort of, they don't really know how to deal with this sort of stuff.
No, it's a gradual process to educate people into...
They've got this specific culture, and then all this new stuff's been introduced, mm-hmm. and they don't really know how to integrate that properly.
No.
We'll deal with it.
Yeah, it's part of what Operation Wallacea is helping with, isn't it?
Yeah, they try and educate the population.
And also the Indonesian government's quite strong on this, or becoming so, wanting to preserve these sort of places.
Yeah, I decided that because I went there to be a research assistant, I wanted to do at least 1 week of research assistant work.
Yeah.
So I was out mostly snorkeling, because there weren't many people who were willing to snorkel. So I was mostly snorkeling. I was working with a girl who was sort of serving fish biodiversity in the seagrass, which was really interesting. I'd not really been out there that much, so it was really cool to sort of see the sort of stuff in the seagrass. And I did various other things. I think if I could go back, I would have stayed another 2 weeks at least, because it was really enjoyable, and there was so much stuff I could have done.
Yeah. You got your skill level up.
And I got my endurance up as well. Yeah. Like, it was so, I think by the end of the third week, I had gotten past the point where everything was exhausting, and like, I'd built up my sort of strength and endurance enough that everything was much more, it was more like rewarding. You didn't come out feeling exhausted. You sort of felt that sort of physical exhaustion that sort of makes you feel excited and, you know, wanting to do more of it.
The length
like
of time
feeling satisfied, I guess you'd say.
Yeah, we had to decide on the length of time beforehand, and it was sort of decided on the basis of,
well, originally I'd planned 6 weeks, but like I had, because when I was sick during the first semester of my first year, I'd missed an exam and it had been deferred to August, and because it was one of my, it wasn't my biology one, it was my earth science subject, which I was less familiar with, I thought I needed extra time to study. Yeah. I wanted a bit of opportunity to have a bit of a break and then study. Whereas if I did the 6 weeks, I figured I'd have to come back and just study straight away.
Yes.
So,
Yeah, it's a shame, but there you go. What can you do?
Yeah.
Let's just finish off by asking you a couple of questions. What do you actually feel you gained from doing this?
Well, I mean, it was just a wonderful experience because I got to meet of interesting people, but I also got to see the reefs and the amount of, there were some really beautiful areas out there that were just lovely and biodiverse, and like, I've never seen anything like that with my own eyes before, and it was just a really wonderful experience
as a biologist.
Yeah,
then that was
and of course I learned how to identify stuff as well, so I could go, oh, that's a parrot fish and that's a butterfly fish, and I don't know what that species is called.
And you got to go and, you told me you went to mangrove area?
Yeah, we did that at the end of the research assistant work, which was, not the research assistant, the reef survey techniques, because they wanted us to, that was the only time I went there, but because we were researching the seagrasses at that point, that was a good area to go out to, and that was really interesting. We were just snorkeling with no weights or anything like that, so you were just floating on the surface, because the bed of the mangroves was like a few meters away, like 2 meters away from you, and you had all these upside down jellyfish and stuff. It was really beautiful and amazing.
Wow, I didn't know anything about them.
I mean, of course, I also learned how to scuba dive, which I can do.
Like, of course you do.
I have most of the gear now as well, except for the BCD and the air tanks.
What's a BCD, by the way?
It's your, I think it stands for buoyancy control device. It's basically this big sort of, it's kind of like a jacket, but it's the thing that inflates or deflates to control your buoyancy.
All right, okay. Yeah, I don't know anything about
And then your regs are like your regulator, which is what you breathe through, and also you have your main reg and your secondary reg for emergencies, or if your buddy's out of oxygen. And then you have like a, and then you have a bit that clips into your BCD, and that's where you get the air form, and then you get like a, your SPG, which is a thing that tells you how much air you've got left and what depth you are at.
I'll put that down.
Was really good. I want to do more diving again. I think if I ever go out to Indonesia again on holiday, I want to go diving.
Do some proper diving there. So well, that leads me to my last question, which is, would you do this again if you got the chance?
Yeah, I think I would. Problem right now is that I probably want to go out and do some proper research assistant work, you know, like a specific project, because that's the sort of thing companies and organizations expect you to have on your CV as a biologist.
Yes. Yeah.
So I'd probably have to go out and do that. And also, I don't want to spend, it was quite an expensive trip, and I don't want to have to spend that much money. I think if I do like a something with Operation Wallacea again, I'll do the group leader thing, because that was something we were offered to do.
Okay.
I'll do the group leader deal and try and recruit people to go on an expedition. I don't know if I'd do a ocean one again. I might, but one of the ones that interested me the most was the terrestrial one out in Africa, where you basically live out in the savannah in huts and stuff, and not huts, in tents, and like, you're literally out in the savannah, so they have, like, those lion-proof fences around the campsite. And you go out into the savannah on foot, and they were saying how it's quite dangerous. It can be quite dangerous work because you can actually have, like, face-to-face encounters with wildlife, and you get taught, like, specific ways to avoid them or how to deal with them, and you have to, you know, it's quite strenuous, but it's very rewarding. And I'd like to, I think it's another extreme, you know. I've sort of experienced the sort of marine biology side, but I kind of also want to experience that sort of very, you know.
Africa is a good place to experience that terrestrial sort of very cool.
Side
very
of
cool.
biology.
Well, I hope that comes to be. We'll have to see.
Yeah,
anyway.
Hopefully I'll have time on one summer holiday or something.
All right. let's call a halt at that point. Thanks very much, Clara, and hope everybody enjoyed hearing about your experiences.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Bye then.
You've been listening to Hacker Public Radio at hackerpublicradio.org. We are a community podcast network that releases shows every weekday, Monday through Friday. Today's show, like all our shows, was contributed by an HBR listener like yourself. If you ever thought of recording a podcast, then click on our contribute link to find out how easy it really is. Hacker Public Radio was founded by the Digital Dog Pound and the Infonomicon Computer Club and is part of the binary revolution at binrev.com. If you have comments on today's show, please email the host directly, leave a comment on the website, or record a follow-up episode yourself. Unless otherwise stated, today's show is released under a Creative Commons Attribution Share Alike 3.0 license.